Following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the seventh reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety and that some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In our last reading, Etienne, thinking he heard someone coming, hid in the cellar. He told Marie-Laure he is afraid of being outside because of what happened during the war. When he calmed down, he took her through the small door in the back of the bedroom on the sixth floor. It leads to the attic. Using headphones, she listens to the recordings Etienne and her grandfather Henri made before the war. The attic serves as a receiver and transmitter of radio waves, with the antenna going up the chimney. The perfumer in Saint-Malo, Claude Lavitte, pays farmers to bring him butchered lambs and rabbits, which he carries in suitcases to sell on the black market in Paris. When he sees Marie-Laure's father measuring and taking notes as he walks around Saint-Malo in order to build a model for Marie-Laure, he plans to tell the Germans. Everyone in Saint-Malo must now relinquish all radio receivers in their possession. All of Etienne's radios, except what is in the attic, are handed over to the Germans. Sergeant Major von Rumpel went to the Museum of Natural History in Paris, seeking the Sea of Flames. Using his unnatural patience, he gets the director to open a series of safes and boxes which contain a felt bag with a blue stone as big as a pigeon's egg. Etienne and Marie-Laure move the massive wardrobe in front of the door to the attic to protect the radio transmitter. Werner works every evening in Dr. Hauptmann's lab, where he is now, as we continue with All the Light We Cannot See. He wonders if Jutta has forgiven him. Her letters consist mostly of banalities. We are busy, Frau Elena says hello, or else arrive in his bunk room so full of censor marks that their meaning has disintegrated. Does she grieve over his absence, or has she calcified her feelings, protected herself, as he is learning to do? Volkheimer, like Hauptmann, seems full of contradictions. To the other boys, the giant is a brute, an instrument of pure strength. And yet sometimes, when Hauptmann is away in Berlin, Volkheimer will disappear into the doctor's office and return with a Grunding tube radio and hook up the short wave antenna and fill the lab with classical music. Mozart, Bach, even the Italian Vivaldi. The more sentimental, the better. The huge boy will lean back in a chair so that it makes squeaking protestations beneath his bulk and lets his eyelids slip to half-mast. Why always triangles? What is the purpose of the transceiver they are building? What two points does Hauptmann know, and why does he need to know the third?
It's only numbers, cadet, Hauptmann says, a favorite maxim. Pure math. You have to accustom yourself to thinking that way.
Werner tries out various theories on Friedrich, but Friedrich, he's learning, moves about as if in the grip of a dream, his trousers too big around the waist, the hems already falling out. His eyes are both intense and vague. He hardly seems to realize when he misses targets in marksmanship. Most nights, Friedrich murmurs to himself before falling asleep. Bits of poems, the habits of geese, bats he's heard swooping past the windows. Birds, always birds.
No. Attic turns, Werner. They fly in from the South Pole to the North Pole, true navigators of the globe, probably the most migratory creatures ever to live, 70,000 kilometers a year.
A metallic wintry light settles over the stables and vineyard and rifle range, and songbirds streak over the hills, great scattershot nets of passerines on their way south, a migratory thoroughway running right over the spires of the school.
Once in a while, a flock descends into one of the huge lindens on the grounds and seethes beneath its leaves. Some of the senior boys, 16- and 17-year-old cadets, who are allowed freer access to ammunition, develop a fondness for firing volleys into the trees to see how many birds they can hit. The tree looks uninhabited and calm. Then someone fires and its crown shatters in all directions, 100 birds exploding into flight in a half second, shrieking as though the whole tree has flown apart. In the dormitory window one night, Friedrich rests his forehead against the glass.
I hate him for that.
The dinner bell rings and everyone trots off, Friedrich coming in last with his taffy-colored hair and wounded eyes, bootlaces trailing. Werner washes Friedrich's mess tin for him. He shares homework answers, shoe polish, sweets from Dr. Hauptmann. They run next to each other during field exercises. A brass pin weighs lightly on each of their lapels. 114 hobnail boots spark against pebbles on the trail. The castle with its towers and battlements looms below them like some misty vision of foregone glory. Werner's blood gallops through his ventricles, his thoughts on Hauptmann's receiver, on solder, fuses, batteries, antennas, his boot, and Friedrich's touch the ground at exactly the same moment. SSG-35-ANA-315-NLWUX, duplicate of telephone telegram, 10 December 1940. M. Daniel LeBlanc, Saint-Malo, France. Return to Paris, end of month, equals travel securely, equals. Bath. One final burst of frenetic gluing and sanding, and Marie-Laure's father has completed the model of Saint-Malo. It is unpainted, imperfect, striped with a half dozen different types of wood and missing details. But it's complete enough for his daughter to use if she must. The irregular polygon of the island, framed by ramparts, each of its 865 buildings in place. He feels ragged. For weeks, logic has been failing him. The stone the museum has asked him to protect is not real. If it were, the museum would have sent men already to collect it. Why then, when he puts a magnifying glass to it, do its depths reveal tiny daggers of flames? Why does he hear footfalls behind him when there are none? And why does he find himself entertaining the brainless notion that the stone he carries in the linen sachet in his pocket has brought him misfortune, has put Marie-Laure in danger, may indeed have precipitated the whole invasion of France? Idiotic. Ludicrous. He has tried every test he can think of without involving another soul. Tried folding it between pieces of felt and striking it with a hammer. It did not shatter. Tried scratching it with a halved pebble of quartz. It did not scratch. Tried holding it to candle flame, drowning it, boiling it. He has hidden the jewel under the mattress, in his tool case, in his shoe. For several hours one night, he tucked it into Madame Manette's geraniums in a window flower box. Then convinced himself the geraniums were wilting and dug the stone out. This afternoon, a familiar face looms in the train station, maybe 4 or 5 back in the queue. He has seen this man before, pudgy, sweating, multi-chinned. They lock eyes. The man's gaze slides away. Etienne's neighbor, the perfumer. Weeks ago, while taking measurements for the model, the locksmith saw this same man atop the ramparts, pointing a camera out to sea. Not a man to trust, Madame Manette said, but he is just a man waiting in line to buy a ticket. Logic, the principles of validity, every lock has its key. For more than 2 weeks, the director's telegram has echoed in his head. Such a maddeningly ambitious choice for that final directive, travel securely. Does it mean to bring the stone or leave it behind? Bring Marie-Laure or leave her behind? Travel by train or by some other theoretically more secure means? And what if, the locksmith considers, the telegram was not sent from the director at all? Round and round the questions run. When it is his turn at the window, he buys a ticket for a single passenger on the morning train to René, and then on to Paris, and walks the narrow, sunless streets back to the Rue Vaubarais. He will do this, and then it will be over. Back to work. Staff the key pound. Lock things away. In a week, he will ride unburdened back to Brittany and collect Marie-Laure. For supper, Madame Manek serves stew and baguettes. Afterward, he leads Marie-Laure up the rickety flights of stairs to the third-floor bath. He fills the big iron tub and turns his back as she undresses.
"Use as much soap as you would like," he says. "I bought extra."
The train ticket remains folded in his pocket like a betrayal. She lets him wash her hair. Over and over, Marie-Laure trawls her fingers through the suds, as though trying to gauge their weight. There has always been a sliver of panic in him, deeply buried when it comes to his daughter, a fear that he is no good as a father, that he is doing everything wrong, that he never quite understood the rules. All those Parisian mothers pushing buggies through the Jardin des Plantes or holding up cardigans in department stores, it seemed to him that those women nodded to each other as they passed, as though each possessed some secret knowledge that he did not. How do you ever know for certain that you are doing the right thing? There is pride, too, though, pride that he has done it alone, that his daughter is so curious, so resilient. There is the humility of being a father to someone so powerful, as if he were only a narrow conduit for another greater thing. That's how it feels right now, he thinks, kneeling beside her, rinsing her hair, as though his love for his daughter will outstrip the limits of his body. The walls could fall away, even the whole city, and the brightness of that feeling would not wane. The drain moans, the cluttered house crowds in close. Marie turns up her wet face.
"You're leaving, aren't you?"
He's glad just now that she cannot see him.
"Madame told me about the telegram." "I won't be long, Marie, a week, 10 days at most."
"When?"
"Tomorrow, before you wake."
She leans over her knees. Her back is long and white and split by the knobs of her vertebra. She used to fall asleep holding his index finger in her fist. She used to sprawl with her books beneath the key-pound bench and move her hands like spiders across the pages.
"Am I to stay here?"
"With Madame and Etienne." He hands her a towel and helps her climb onto the tile and waits outside while she puts on her nightgown. Then he walks her up to the sixth floor and into their little room, though he knows she does not need to be guided, and he sits on the edge of the bed, and she kneels beside the model and sets three fingers on the steeple of the cathedral. He finds the hairbrush, does not bother turning on the lamp.
10 days, Papa?
At most. The walls creak, the window between the curtains is black, the town prepares to sleep. Somewhere out there, German U-boats glide above the underwater canyons, and 30-foot squid ferry their huge eyes through the cold dark.
Have we ever spent a night apart?
No. His gaze flits through the unlit room. The stone in his pocket seems almost to pulse. If he manages to sleep tonight, what will he dream?
Can I go out while you're gone, Papa?
Once I get back, I promise. As tenderly as he can, he draws the brush through the damp strands of his daughter's hair. Between strokes, they can hear the sea wind rattle the window. Marie-Laure's hands whisper across the houses as she recites the names of the streets.
Rue de Coudier, Rue Jacques Cartier, Rue Vaubarais.
He says, you'll know them all in a week. Marie-Laure's fingers rove to the outer ramparts, the sea beyond.
10 days,
she says, at most. Weakest, number 2. December sucks the light from the castle. The sun hardly clears the horizon before sinking away. Snow falls once, twice, then stays locked over the lawns. Has Werner ever seen snow this white? snow that was not fouled immediately with ash and coal dust. The only emissaries from the outside world are the occasional songbird who lands in the lindens beyond the quadrangle, blown astray by distant storm or battle or both, and two callow-faced corporals who come into the refectory every week or so, always after the prayer, always just as the boys have placed the first morsel of dinner in their mouths, to pass beneath the blazonry and stop behind a cadet and whisper in his ear that his father has been killed in action. On other nights, a prefect yells, "Achtung!" and the boys stand at their benches, and Bastion the commandant waddles in. The boys look down at their food in silence, while Bastion walks the rows, trailing a single index finger across their backs.
"Homesick! We mustn't trouble ourselves over our homes. In the end, we all come home to the Führer. What other home matters?"
"No other," shouts the boys.
Every afternoon, no matter the weather, the commandant blows his whistle, and the 14-year-olds trot outside, and he looms over them with his coat stretched across his belly and his medals chiming and the rubber hose twirling.
"There are two kinds of death," he says,
the clouds of his breath plunging out into the cold.
"You can fight like a lion, or you can go as easy as lifting a hair from a cup of milk. The nothings, the nobodies, they die easy."
He sweeps his eyes along the ranks and swings his hose and widens his eyes dramatically.
"How will you boys die?"
One windy afternoon, he pulls Helmut Rodell out of line. Helmut is a small, unpromising child from the south who keeps his hands balled in fists nearly all his waking hours.
"And who is it, Rodell? In your opinion, who is the weakest member of the Corps?"
The commandant twirls the hose. Helmut Rodell takes no time.
"Him, sir."
Werner feels something heavy fall through him. Rodell is pointing directly at Friedrich. Bastion calls Friedrich forward. If fear darkens his friend's face, Werner cannot see it. Friedrich looks distracted, almost philosophical. Bastion drapes his hose around his neck and trudges across the field, snow to his shins, taking his time, until he is little more than a dark lump at the far edge. Werner tries to make eye contact with Friedrich, but his eyes are a mile away. The commandant raises his right arm and yells, "Ten!" and the wind frays the word across the long expanse. Friedrich blinks several times, as he often does when addressed in class, waiting for his internal life to catch up with his external one.
"Nine!"
"Run!"
hisses Werner. Friedrich is a decent runner, faster than Werner, but the commandant seems to count quickly this afternoon, and Friedrich's head start has been abbreviated, and the snow hampers him, and he cannot be over 20 yards away when Bastion raises his left arm. The boys explode into movement. Werner runs with the others, trying to stay in the back of the pack, their rifles beating in syncopation against their backs. Already the fastest of the boys seems to be running faster than usual, as though tired of being outrun. Friedrich runs hard, but the fastest boys are greyhounds, harvested from all over the nation for their speed and eagerness to obey, and they seem to Werner to be running more fervently, more conclusively than they have before. They are impatient to find out what will happen if someone is caught. Friedrich is 15 strides from Bastion when they haul him down. The group coalesces around the front runners as Friedrich and his pursuers get to their feet, all of them pasted with snow. Bastion strides up. The cadets encircle their instructor, chests heaving, many with their hands on their knees. The breath of the boys pulses out before them in a collective fleeting cloud that is stripped away quickly by the wind. Friedrich stands in the middle, panting and blinking his long eyelashes.
"It usually does not take so long," says Bastion mildly, almost as if to himself, "for the first to be caught."
Friedrich squints at the sky. Bastion says, "Cadet,
Are you the weakest?
I don't know, sir.
You don't know? A pause. Into Bastian's face flows an undercurrent of antagonism. Look at me when you speak.
Some people are weak in some ways, sir. Others in other ways.
The commandant's lips thin and his eyes narrow, and an expression of slow and intense malice rises in his face, as though a cloud has drifted away, and for a moment Bastian's true, deformed character has come glaring through. He pulls the hose from around his neck and hands it to Rodel. Rodel blinks up at his bulk.
Go on, then, prods Bastian.
In some other context, he might be encouraging a reluctant boy to step into cold water.
Do him some good.
Rodel looks down at the hose, black, 3 feet long, stiff in the cold. What might be several seconds pass, though they feel to Werner like hours, and the wind tears through the frosted grass, sending zephyrs and wisps of snow sirening off across the white, and a sudden nostalgia for Zollverein rolls through him in a wave. Boyhood afternoons wandering the soot-stained warrens, towing his little sister in the wagon. Muck in the alleys, the hoarse shouts of work crews, the boys in their dormitory sleeping head to toe while their coats and trousers hang from hooks along the walls. Frau Elena's midnight passage among the beds like an angel, murmuring, I know it's cold, but I'm right beside you, see? Jutta, close your eyes. Rodel steps forward and swings the hose and smacks Friedrich with it across the shoulder. Friedrich takes a step backward. The wind slashes across the field. Bastian says, Again! Everything becomes soaked in a hideous and wondrous slowness. Rodel rears back and strikes. This time, he catches Friedrich on the jaw. Werner forces his mind to keep sending up images of home. The laundry, Frau Elena's overworked pink fingers, dogs in the alleys, steam blowing from stacks. Every part of him wants to scream. Is this not wrong? But here it is right. It takes such a long time. Friedrich withstands a third blow. Again, commands Bastian. On the fourth, Friedrich throws up his arms and the hose smacks against his forearms and he stumbles. Rodel swings again and Bastian says, In your shining example, Christ leads the way ever and always. And the whole afternoon turns sideways, torn open. Werner watches the scene recede as though observing it from the far end of a tunnel. A small white field, a group of boys, bare trees, a toy castle, none of it any more real than Frau Elena's stories about her Alsatian childhood or Jutta's drawings of Paris. Six more times he hears Rodel swing and the hose whistle and the strangely dead smack of the rubber striking Friedrich's hands, shoulders, and face. Friedrich can walk for hours in the woods, can identify warblers 50 yards away simply by hearing their song. Friedrich hardly ever thinks of himself. Friedrich is stronger than he is in every imaginable way. Werner opens his mouth but closes it again. He drowns. He shuts his eyes, his mind. At some point, the beating stops. Friedrich is face down in the snow. Sir? Says Rodel, panting. Bastian takes back the length of hose from Rodel and drapes it around his neck and reaches underneath his belly to hitch up his belt. Werner kneels beside Friedrich and turns him onto his side. Blood is running from his nose or eye or ear, maybe all three. One of his eyes is already swollen shut. The other remains open. His attention, Werner realizes, is on the sky, tracing something up there. Werner risks a glance upward, a single hawk riding the wind. Bastian says, Up! Werner stands. Friedrich does not move. Bastian says, Up! More quietly this time, and Friedrich gets to a knee. He stands, wobbling. His cheek is gashed and leaks tendrils of blood. Splotches of moisture show on his back from where the snow has melted into his shirt. Werner gives Friedrich his arm.
Cadet, are you the weakest?
Friedrich does not look at the commandant.
No, sir.
Hawk still gyring up there. The portly commandant chews on a thought for a moment. Then his clear voice rings out, flying above the company, urging them into a run. 57 cadets cross the grounds and jog up the snowy path into the forest. Friedrich runs in his place beside Werner, his left eye swelling, twin networks of blood peeling back across his cheeks, his collar wet and brown. The branches seethe and clatter. All 57 boys sing in unison. We shall march onwards, even if everything crashes down in pieces. For today the nation hears us, and tomorrow the whole world. Winter in the forests of old Saxony. Werner does not risk another glance toward his friend. He quick steps through the cold, an unloaded 5-round rifle over his shoulder. He is almost 15 years old. The arrest of the locksmith. They seize him outside Vitray, hours from Paris. Two policemen in plain clothes bundle him off a train while a dozen passengers stare. He is questioned in a van and again in an ice-cold mezzanine office decorated with poorly executed watercolors of ocean-going steamers. The first interrogators are French. An hour later, they become German. They brandish his notebook and tool case. They hold up his key ring and count 7 different skeleton keys. What do these unlock, they want to know, and how do you employ these tiny files and saws? What about this notebook full of architectural measurements?
A model for my daughter.
Keys for the museum where I work. Please. They frog march him to a cell. The doors lock and hinges are so big and antiquarian, they must be Louis Kahn's. Maybe Napoleon. Any hour now, the director or his people will show up and explain everything. Certainly this will happen. In the morning, the Germans run him through a second, more laconic spell of questioning while a typist clatters away in the corner. They seem to be accusing him of plotting to destroy the Chateau de Saint-Malo, though why they might believe this is not clear. Their French is barely adequate, and they seem more interested in their questions than his answers. They deny access to paper, to linens, to a telephone. They have photographs of him.
He yearns for cigarettes. He lies face up on the floor and imagines himself kissing Marie Laura once on each eye while she sleeps. 2 days after his arrest, he is driven to a holding pen a few miles outside Strasbourg. Through fence slots, he watches a column of uniformed schoolgirls walk double file in the winter sunshine. Guards bring prepackaged sandwiches, hard cheese, sufficient water. In the pen, maybe 30 others sleep on straw laid atop frozen mud. Mostly French, but some Belgians, 4 Flemings, 2 Walloons. All have been accused of crimes they speak of only with reticence, anxious about what traps might lurk within any question he puts to them. At night, they trade rumors and whispers. "We will only be in Germany for a few months," someone says, and the word goes twisting down the line. "Merely to help with spring planting while their men are at war. Then they'll send us home." Each man thinks this is impossible, and then it might be true. Just a few months, then home. No officially appointed lawyer, no military tribunal. Marie Laura's father spends 3 days shivering in the holding pen. No rescue arrives from the museum. No limousine from the director grinds up the lane. They will not let him write letters. When he demands to use a telephone, the guards don't bother to laugh.
"Do you know the last time we used a telephone?"
Every hour is a prayer for Marie Laura, every breath. On the 4th day, all the prisoners are piled onto a cattle truck
and driven east.
We are close to Germany, the men whisper.
They can glimpse it on the far side of the river, low clumps of naked trees bracketed by snow-dusted fields, black rows of vineyards, four disconnected strands of gray smoke melt into a white sky. The locksmith squints.
Germany?
Looks no different from this side of the river. It may as well be the edge of a cliff. 4. 8 August 1944. The Fort of La Cité. Sergeant Major von Rumpel climbs a ladder in the dark. He can feel the lymph nodes on either side of his neck compressing his esophagus and trachea, his weight like a rag on the rungs. The two gunners inside the periscope turret watch from beneath the rims of their helmets, not offering help, not saluting. The turret is crowned with a steel dome and is used primarily to range larger guns positioned farther below. It offers views of the sea to the west, the cliffs below, all strung with entangling wire, and directly across the water, a half mile away, the burning city of St. Malo. Artillery has stopped for the moment, and the pre-dawn fires inside the walls take on a steady middle life, an adulthood. The western edge of the city has become a holocaust of crimson and carmine from which rise multiple towers of smoke. The largest has curdled into a pillar like the cloud of tephra and ash and steam that billows atop an erupting volcano. From afar, the smoke appears strangely solid, as though carved from luminous wood. All along its perimeter, sparks rise and ash falls, and administrative documents flutter, utility plans, purchase orders, tax records. With binoculars, von Rumpel watches what might be bats go flaming and careening out over the ramparts. A geyser of sparks erupts deep within a house. An electrical transformer, or hoarded fuel, or maybe a delayed-action bomb, and it looks to him as if lightning lashes the town from within. One of the gunners makes unimaginative comments about the smoke, a dead horse he can see at the base of the walls, the intensity of certain quadrants of fire. As though they are noblemen in grandstands viewing fortress warfare in the years of the Crusaders, von Rumpel tugs his collar against the bulges in his throat, tries to swallow. The moon sets, and the eastern sky lightens, the hem of night pulling away, taking stars with it one by one until only two are left. Vega, maybe, or Venus, he never learned.
Schutzspire's gone, says the second gunner.
A day ago, above the zigzag rooftops, the cathedral spire pointed straight up, higher than anything else. Not this morning. Soon the sun is above the horizon, and the orange of flames gives way to the black of smoke, rising along the western walls and blowing like a call across the citadel. Finally, for a few seconds, the smoke parts long enough for von Rumpel to peer into the serrated maze of the city and pick out what he's looking for. The upper section of a tall house with a broad chimney. Two windows visible, the glass out, one shutter hanging, three in place. Number 4, Rue Vaubray, still intact. Seconds pass, smoke veils it again. A single airplane tracks across the deepening blue incredibly high. Von Rumpel retreats down the long ladder into the tunnels of the fort below, trying not to limp, not to think of the bulges in his groin. In the underground commissary, men sit against the wall spooning oatmeal from their upturned helmets. The electric lights cast them in alternating pools of glare and shadow. Von Rumpel sits on an ammunition box and eats cheese from a tube. The colonel in charge of defending St. Malo has made speeches to these men, speeches about valor, about how any hour the Hermann Göring division will break the American line at Avranches. Now reinforcements will pour in from Italy and possibly Belgium, tanks and Stukas, truckloads of 50-millimeter mortars,
how the people of Berlin believe in them like a nun believes in God, how no one will abandon his post, and if he does, he'll be executed as a deserter. But von Rumpel is thinking now of the vine inside him, a black vine that has grown branches through his legs and arms, gnawing his abdomen from the inside. Here in this peninsular fortress just outside St. Malo, cut off from the retreating lines, it seems only a matter of time until Canadians and Brits and the bright American eyes of the 83rd Division will be swarming the city, scouring the homes for marauding Huns, doing whatever it is they do when they take prisoners. Only a matter of time until the black vine chokes off his heart.
What? A soldier beside him. Von Rumpel sniffs. I do not think I said anything.
The soldier squints back into the oatmeal in his helmet. Von Rumpel squeezes out the last of the vile, salty cheese and drops the empty tube between his feet. The house is still there. His army still holds the city. For a few hours the fires will burn, and then the Germans will swarm like ants back to their positions and fight for another day. He will wait, wait and wait and wait, and when the smoke clears, he will go in.
Attila de Reparation.
Bernd, the engineer, squirms in pain, grinding his face into the back of the golden armchair. Something wrong with his leg, and something worse with his chest. The radio is hopeless. The power cable has been severed, and the lead to the above-ground antenna is lost, and Werner would not be surprised if the selector panel is broken. In the weakening amber of Volkheimer's field light, he stares at one crushed plug after another. The bombing seems to have destroyed the hearing in his left ear. His right, as far as he can tell, is gradually coming back. Beyond the ringing, he begins to hear. Ticking of fires as they cool. Groaning of the hotel above. Strange miscellaneous dripping. And Volkheimer, as he hacks intermittently, insanely, at the rubble blocking the stairwell. Volkheimer's technique, apparently, is this. He crouches beneath the buckled ceiling, panting, holding a piece of twisted rebar in one hand. He switches on his flashlight and scans the packed stairwell for anything he might drag out of it, memorizing positions. Then he switches off the light to preserve its battery and goes at his task in the darkness. When the light comes back on, the mess of the stairwell looks the same. An impacted welter of metal and brickwork and timber so thick that it's hard to believe 20 men could get through. Please, Volkheimer says, whether he knows he is saying it out loud or not, Werner cannot say. But Werner hears it in his right ear like a distant prayer. Please, please. As though everything in the war to this point was tolerable to 21-year-old Frank Volkheimer, but not this final injustice. The fires above ought to have sucked the last oxygen out of this hole by now. They all should have asphyxiated. Debts paid, accounts settled, and yet they breathe. The three splintered beams in the ceiling hold up God knows what load. 10 tons of carbonized hotel and the corpses of 8 anti-aircraft men and untold unexploded ordnance. Maybe Werner for his 10,000 small betrayals and Bernd for his innumerable crimes and Volkheimer for being the instrument, the executor of the orders, the blade of the Reich. Maybe the three of them have some greater price to pay, some final sentence to be handed down. First a corsair's cellar, built to safeguard gold, weapons, and eccentrics' beekeeping equipment, then a wine cellar, then a handyman's nook. Atelier de réparation, thinks Werner, a chamber in which to make reparations. As appropriate a place as any. Certainly, there would be people in the world who believe these three have reparations to make. two cans. When Marie-Laure wakes, the little model house is pinned beneath her chest, and she is sweating through her great-uncle's coat. Is it dawn? She climbs the ladder and presses her ear to the trap door. No more sirens. Maybe the house burned to the ground while she slept, or else she slept through the last hours of the war and the city has been liberated. There could be people in the streets, volunteers, gendarmes, fire brigades, even Americans. She should go up through the trap door and walk out the front door onto the Rue Vaubarais. But what if Germany has held the city? What if Germans are right now marching from house to house, shooting whomever they please? She will wait. At any moment, Etienne could be making his way toward her, fighting with his last breath to reach her. Or he is crouched somewhere, cradling his head, seeing demons. Or he is dead. She tells herself to save the bread, but she is famished, and the loaf is getting stale, and before she knows it, she has finished it. If only she had brought her novel down with her. Marie-Laure rows the cellar in her stocking feet. Here's a rolled rug. It's hollow, filled with what smell like wood shavings, mice. Here's a crate that contains old papers, antique lamp, Madame Manette's canning supplies. And here at the back of the shelf near the ceiling, two small miracles, full cans. Hardly any food remains in the entire kitchen, only cornmeal and a sheaf of lavender and two or three bottles of skunked Beaujolais, but down here in the cellar, two heavy cans. Peas, beans, corn kernels maybe? Not oil, she prays. Aren't oil cans smaller? When she shakes them, they offer no clues. Marie-Laure tries to calculate the chances that one might contain Madame Manette's peaches, the white peaches from Languedoc that she'd buy by the crate and peel and quarter and boil with sugar. The whole kitchen would fill with their smell and color, Marie-Laure's fingers sticky with them, a kind of rapture. Two cans, Etienne missed. But to raise one's hopes is to risk their falling further. Peas or beans, these would be more than welcome. She deposits one can in each pocket of her uncle's coat and checks again for the little house in the pocket of her dress and sits on a trunk and clasps her cane in both hands and tries not to think about her bladder. Once, when she was 8 or 9, her father took her to the Pantheon in Paris to describe Foucault's pendulum. Its bob, he said, was a golden sphere shaped like a child's top. It swung from a wire that was 67 meters long. Because its trajectory changed over time, he explained, it proved beyond all doubt that the earth rotated. But what Marie-Laure remembered standing at the rail as it whistled past was her father saying that Foucault's pendulum would never stop. It would keep swinging. She understood. After she and her father left the Pantheon, after she had fallen asleep that night, after she had forgotten about it and lived her entire life and died. Now it is as if she can hear the pendulum in the air in front of her, that huge golden bob as wide across as a barrel, swinging on and on, never stopping, grooving and regrooving its inhuman truth into the floor. Number 4, Rue Vaubarais. Ashes, ashes, snow in August. The shelling resumed sporadically after breakfast, and now, around 6 p.m., has ceased. A machine gun fires somewhere, a sound like a chain, beads passing through fingers. Sergeant Major von Rumpel carries a canteen, a half-dozen ampules of morphine, and his field pistol. Over the seawall, over the causeway toward the huge smoldering bulwark of St. Malo. Out in the harbor, the jetty has been shattered in multiple places. A half-submerged fishing boat drifts stern up. Inside the old city, mountains of stone blocks, sacks, shutters, branches, iron grillwork, and chimney pots fill the Rue de Dinan. Smashed flower boxes and charred window frames and shattered glass. Some buildings still smoke, and though Von Rumpel keeps a damp handkerchief pressed over his mouth and nose, he has to stop several times to gather his breath. Here a dead horse starting to bloat. Here a chair upholstered in striped green velvet. Here the torn shreds of a canopy proclaim a brasserie. Curtains swing idly from broken windows in the strange, flickering light. They unnerve him. Swallows fly to and fro, looking for lost nests, and someone very far away might be screaming, or it might be the wind. The blasts have stripped many shop signs off their brackets, and the gibbets hang forsaken. A schnauzer trots after him, whining. No one shouts down from a window to warn him away from mines. Indeed, in four blocks, he sees only one soul, a woman outside what was, the day before, the movie house. Dustpan in one hand, broom nowhere to be seen. She looks up at him, dazed. Through an open door behind her, rows of seats have crumpled beneath great slabs of ceiling. Beyond them, the screen stands unblemished, not even stained by smoke.
"Sure's not until 8, she says in her Breton French, and he nods as he limps past.
On the Rue Vauboret, vast quantities of slate tiles have slid off roofs and detonated in the streets. Scraps of burned paper float overhead. No gulls. Even if the house has caught fire, he thinks, the diamond will be there. He will pluck it from the ashes like a warm egg. But the tall, slender house remains nearly unscathed. 11 windows on the facade, most of the glass out. Blue window frames, old granite of grays and tans. 4 of its 6 flower boxes hang on. The mandated list of occupants clings to its front door. M. Etienne Leblanc, age 63. Mademoiselle Marie-Laure Leblanc, age 16. All the dangers he is willing to endure for the Reich, for himself. No one stops him. No shells come whistling in. Sometimes the eye of a hurricane is the safest place to be. What they have. When is it day and when night? Time seems better measured by flashes. Volkheimer's field light flicks off, flicks on. Werner watches Volkheimer's ash-dusted face in the reflected glow, his ministrations as he leans over Bernd. Drink, says Volkheimer's mouth as he holds his canteen to Bernd's lips, and shadows lunge across the broken ceiling like a circle of raids preparing to feast. Bernd twists his face away, panic in his eyes, and tries to examine his leg. The flashlight switches off, and the darkness rushes back. In Werner's duffel, he has his childhood notebook, his blanket, and dry socks, 3 rations. This is all the food they have. Volkheimer has none. Bernd has none. They have only 2 canteens of water, each half empty. Volkheimer has also discovered a bucket of paintbrushes in a corner with some watery sludge in the bottom. But how desperate will they have to become to drink that? 2 stick grenades, Model 24s, 1 in each of the side pockets of Volkheimer's coat. Hollow wood handles on the broom. High explosive charges in a steel can on top. Handheld bombs the boys at Schulpforte called potato mashers. Twice already, Bernd has begged Volkheimer to try one on the impacted mess of the stairwell, to see if they can blast their way out. But to use a grenade down here, in such close quarters, beneath rubble presumably littered with live 88mm shells, would be suicide. Then there's the rifle. Volkheimer's bolt-action carbiner 98K, loaded with 5 rounds. Enough, thinks Werner. Plenty. They would need only 3, 1 for each. Sometimes in the darkness, Werner thinks the cellar may have its own faint light, perhaps emanating from the rubble, the space going a bit redder as the August day above them progresses toward dusk. After a while, he is learning even total darkness is not quite darkness. More than once, he thinks he can see his spread fingers when he passes them in front of his eyes. Werner thinks of his childhood, the skeins of coal dust suspended in the air on winter mornings, settling on windowsills in the children's ears and their lungs, except down there in this hole, the white dust is the inverse, as if he is trapped in some deep mine that is the same, but also the opposite of the one that killed his father. Dark again. Light again. Volkheimer's antic, ash-dusted face materializes in front of Werner, his rank insignia partially torn off one shoulder. With the beam of his field light, he shows Werner that he is holding two bent screwdrivers and a box of electrical fuses. "The radio," he says in Werner's good ear. "Have you slept at all?" Volkheimer turns the light onto his own face. "Before we run out of battery," says his mouth. Werner shakes his head. The radio is hopeless. He wants to close his eyes, forget, give up, wait for the rifle barrel to touch his temple. But Volkheimer wants to make an argument that life is worth living. The filaments of the bulb inside his field light grow yellow, weaker already. Volkheimer's illuminated mouth is red against the blackness. "We are running out of time," his lips say. The building groans. Werner sees green grass, crackling flies, sunlight. The gates of a summer estate opening wide. When death comes for Bernd, it might as well come for him also. Save a second trip. "Your sister," says Volkheimer. "Think of your sister." Tripwire. Her bladder will not hold much longer. She scales the cellar steps and holds her breath and hears nothing for 30 heartbeats. 40. Then she pushes open the trap door and climbs into the kitchen. No one shoots her. She hears no explosions. Marie-Laure crunches over the fallen kitchen shelves and crosses into Madame Manette's tiny apartment, the two cans swinging heavily in her great-uncle's coat, throat stinging, nostrils stinging, the smoke slightly thinner in here. She relieves herself in the bedpan at the foot of Madame Manette's bed, pulls up her stockings, and rebuttons her great-uncle's coat. Is it afternoon? She wishes for the thousandth time that she could talk to her father. Would it be better to go out into the city, especially if it is still daylight, and try to find someone? A soldier would help her. Anyone would. Though even as the thought rises, she doubts it. The unsteady feeling in her legs, she knows, stems from hunger. In the tumult of the kitchen, she cannot find a can opener. But she does find a paring knife in Madame Manette's knife drawer and the large, coarse brick Madame used to prop open the fireplace grate. She will eat whatever is inside one of the two cans. Then she will wait a bit longer in case her uncle comes home, in case she hears anyone pass by, the town crier, a fireman, an American serviceman with gallantry on his mind. If she hears no one by the time she is hungry again, she will go out into what is left of the street. First, she climbs to the third floor to drink from the bathtub. With her lips against its surface, she takes long inward pulls, pooling, burbling in her gut, a trick she and Etienne has learned over 100 insufficient meals. Before you eat, drink as much water as you can, and you will feel full more quickly. "At least, Papa," she says out loud, "I was smart about the water." Then she sits on the third floor landing with her back against the telephone table. She braces one of the cans between her thighs, holds the point of the knife against its lid, and raises the brick to tap down on the knife handle. But before she can bring the brick down, The tripwire behind her jerks, and the bell rings, and someone enters the house. 5. January 1941. January recess. The commandant makes a speech about virtue and family and the emblematic fire that Schopforta boys carry everywhere they go, a bowl of pure flame to stoke the nation's hearts, furor this and furor that, his words crashing into Werner's ears in a familiar battery. One of the most daring boys muttering afterward, "Oh, I've got a hot bowl of something in my core." In the bunk room, Friedrich leans over the rim of his bed. His face presents a map of purples and yellows.
"Why don't you come to Berlin? Father will be working, but you could meet mother."
For 2 weeks, Friedrich has limped around, bruised and slow-footed and puffy, and not once has he spoken to Werner with anything more than his own gentle brand of distracted kindness. Not once has he accused Werner of betrayal, even though Werner did nothing while Friedrich was beaten and has done nothing since, did not hunt down Rodel or point a rifle at Bastion or bang indignantly on Dr. Hauptmann's door demanding justice, as if Friedrich understands already that both have been assigned to their specific courses, that there is no deviating now. Werner says, "I don't have...
Mother will pay for your fare."
Friedrich tilts back up and stares at the ceiling.
"It's nothing."
The train ride is a sleepy six-hour epic. Every hour their rickety car shunted onto a siding to let trains full of soldiers headed for the front hurry past. Finally, Werner and Friedrich disembark at a dim, charcoal-colored station and climb a long flight of stairs, each step painted with the same exclamation. Berlin smokes Junos, and the rise into the streets of the largest city Werner has ever seen. Berlin, the very name like two sharp bells of glory, capital of science, seat of the Führer, nursery to Bohr, Einstein, Staudinger, Bayer. Somewhere in these streets, plastic was invented. X-rays were discovered. Continental drift was identified. What marvels does science cultivate here now? Superman soldiers, Dr. Hauptmann says, and weather-making machines and missiles that can be steered by men 1,000 miles away. The sky drops silver threads of sleet. Gray houses run in converging lines to the horizon, bunched as if to fend off the cold. They pass shops stuffed with hanging meats, and a drunk with a broken mandolin on his lap, and a trio of streetwalkers huddled beneath an awning who catcall the boys in their uniforms.
"I'm sorry, but that's it. We have no more time and have come to the end of the book hour, and today's reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar." The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.